Okay, good morning, members. I'm going to call the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee to order, and I'm going to hand the gavel to Vice Chair Bonner as I go present another bill in committee. So, members, I'm going to hand it over now, and Representative Bonner will take the role and go through the minutes and start the committee. Thanks, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, if we could start with Ms. Hansen, would you be willing to take the role?
Can you hear me? Oh, wonderful.
Yes.
I was just having some technical problems. I'm so relieved. Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz, I just saw Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Morning, present.
Good morning. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Representative Keel. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Buller. Representative Noor.
Noor, present.
Thank you. Representative Novotny.
Novotny's present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandel.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher. Looks like we're all set, Vice Chair Bonner.
All right, thank you, Ms. Hansen. And just as a reminder, we are calling this remote meeting our hearing to order pursuant to House Rules 10.01. With a quorum being present, would one of the members like to move the minutes from February 26, 2021?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of February 26, 2021 for approval.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Just as a reminder to members, please unmute yourself to vote to accept the minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, the minutes have been moved. We do have a robust schedule today, so just a reminder to testifiers up front to make sure that you state your name and any affiliated organization for the record, and please try to confine your remarks to around 2 minutes. We do have 4 bills on the agenda today. So first, we're gonna start off with consideration of House File 1432, which will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Representative Fredericks, you are on the committee, so would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill before the committee.
Wonderful. All right, Representative Fredericks has moved the bill before the committee. Seeing no amendments, Representative Frederick, would you like to tell us about your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm here to talk about House File 1432, which is an update to the Vulnerable Adult Act. The Vulnerable Adult Act created our county-based adult protection system in Minnesota about 40 years ago. Similar to child protection, adult protection teams respond to reports of abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation against vulnerable adults who live in the community, not in long-term care facilities. In doing so, adult protection workers really wear two hats. They investigate a complaint and provide or offer appropriate services to protect the vulnerable adult or address the underlying problem. Most people are likely somewhat familiar with the licensing systems within DHS that regulate services for people, for home and community-based providers in long-term care settings, like nursing homes or assisted living facilities. But adult protection services is different. They investigate and provide services for vulnerable adults who live in their own homes. Many of the perpetrators of abuse and neglect are family members, loved ones, or other trusted caregivers. Unfortunately, elder abuse and vulnerable adult abuse occurs most often in these settings and yet is severely underreported. Adult protection professionals are oftentimes put in tough situations or having to navigate complex family dynamics to investigate and make reports on maltreatment, refer cases to law enforcement, and where possible, provide social service connections to help address the underlying conditions contributing to the maltreatment. Now, lots has changed in the field over the last 40 years. And although the Vulnerable Adult Act has gone through changes, DHS is kind of leading a redesign process to update and modernize the law. The bill is, or this process is in the first phase, and it is a product of a multi-year collaborative approach that DHS has engaged in. They've worked with county stakeholders, disability and aging advocates, and service providers, and other state agency representatives. The changes in this bill represent some of the suggestions with broad basis of support from participants. And Madam Chair, I would like to turn it over to Mary McGurn from the Adult Protection, who is a Adult Protection Supervisor from DHS.
Good morning, Madam Chair and community members. My name is Mary McGurn. I'm Adult Protection Supervisor with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'm going to walk you through this proposal section by section. We'll start with section one, which is reporting. This section cleans up old language regarding reporting methods used by mandated reporters for consistency with the 2012 Reform 2020 legislation that centralized the state's common entry point system for reporting suspected vulnerable adult maltreatment to a single system operated under the Department of Human Services with phone and web-based reporting options for mandated reporters. Section 2 cleans up old language for consistency, again, with Reform 2020, the 2012 legislation, for the common entry point moving from a county-based reporting system to a state-centralized system for reporting suspected vulnerable adult maltreatment. This authorizes report fields to collect information from reporters that support lead investigative agencies, which would be the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, and county agencies, in making intake and screening decisions in response to the report of suspected maltreatment in investigation of the person alleged responsible and to provide immediate safety to the vulnerable adult who's the subject of the report. Section 3 is a requirement for each county agency to provide information to the public on the criteria used by that county's adult protection for decisions on which vulnerable adult maltreatment reports are screened in. Not every report that is made and referred to a county agency is accepted for investigation or adult protective services. And unlike child protective services, in adult protection or in APS, each county may apply their own unique guidelines to decide which vulnerable adult maltreatment report to accept or screen in, or which reports to screen out or not accept for investigation of the person alleged responsible for an allegation of physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, caregiver neglect or neglect of the vulnerable adult by the vulnerable adult of their own needs or financial exploitation. And this screening in decision also includes the simultaneous adult protective service interventions for the vulnerable adult to stop the maltreatment and prevent reoccurrence of the maltreatment. County prioritization guidelines take priority over standard decision-making tools and policy guidance offered by the Department of Human Services for making decisions that align with the statute. And this proposal will support the public and mandated reporters in understanding why a report that appears to meet the statutory criteria for adult protective services under the Vulnerable Adult Act was not accepted by the county, and will help reporters to understand the inconsistencies that they may be seeing across counties in adult protection service decisions. Section 4. This section applies to all lead investigative agencies, including counties, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Health, unlike most of this proposal, which is specific to counties. This one is for all lead investigative agencies, and it provides statewide consistency across counties and lead investigative agencies. It provides authority consistent to that of child protection, and this part is specific to adult protection, for adult protection to gather information during their intake in order to make good decisions on which reports adult protection should screen in and accept for investigation and protective services, and which reports should be screened out. And this supports the safety, dignity, and healing of maltreated vulnerable adults by allowing adult protection to take in the information necessary. This also supports safety and dignity for vulnerable adults by requiring that lead investigative agencies share information with the vulnerable adult or their guardian or legal surrogate about allegations of maltreatment that are accepted for investigation or services so that they're aware that there was a report and that it is being investigated and services will be offered. This also promotes trauma-informed practices and protection of the person by requiring all lead investigative agencies provide information to the vulnerable adult or their guardian or surrogate on the investigation guidelines, the evidence standards used for making determinations as to whether or not the allegation occurred or not, and the timeframes for making the investigation decisions on if the maltreatment occurred or not. This section also improves consistency in person-centered practices by allowing adult protection to coordinate with other agencies, family members, service providers, and informal supports for the vulnerable adult who can help stop the maltreatment and prevent reoccurrence of the vulnerable adult being abused, neglected, or exploited. Currently, the Vulnerable Adult Act gives APS authority to share information to further an investigation, but not to share information with those who may be able to help protect the vulnerable adult, like a family. This also clarifies that when county is the lead investigative agency, the investigative findings that involve an unlicensed individual, like a family member, friend, neighbor, are not public, that the findings are not public, and that the investigation findings are provided to the person who was investigated, regardless of the finding. Currently, the Vulnerable Adult Act states that when the person alleged responsible is a family member or a friend or a PCA, APS involves the person being investigated only if the investigation is substantiated or determined true. And this means that if the investigation is inconclusive or false, the person alleged responsible is not required to be informed of the outcome. This can create trauma for the innocent person who is investigated and can impact family relationships. This clears that up and provides clear guidance for county agencies. It also provides authority for adult protection to notify the PCA agency of the investigation decision when an unlicensed PCA was alleged responsible. This safeguards vulnerable adults and prevents maltreatment. Section 5, this section prohibits the currently authorized practice that a family member or a guardian who's purported to be acting on behalf of the vulnerable adult may request the panel reconsider a determination of maltreatment of their own maltreatment of the vulnerable adult. And this will stop that so that guardians and family members who are determined to have maltreated a vulnerable adult no longer have the ability to ask that the panel reconsider their own maltreatment decision or their own maltreatment. And section 6, this is a recommendation that was made to the legislature by experts and advocates who sit on the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel. This came through in their annual report. This recommendation is based on the panel's experience of inconsistency in lead investigative agency interview practices, that vulnerable adults are not always consistently interviewed based on a decision about that person, that vulnerable adult's capacity. This section aligns with research that people with dementia and other cognitive impairments may still have the ability to express an experience of maltreatment and still have the ability, may have the ability to express their opinions or thoughts or impacts. This supports the vulnerable adult's dignity and safety by requiring that all lead investigative agencies, county agencies, DHS, and MDH are consistent in investigative protocols for interviewing the reporter, the vulnerable adult, the person or facility alleged responsible, and requires that case managers, ombudsmen, witnesses, and other support persons are interviewed when appropriate to further the investigation. Section 7 protects vulnerable adults by allowing adult protective services to share data to engage informal supports like family or friends or other agencies or cultural service providers in the protection of the vulnerable adult and makes culturally responsive service referrals for the vulnerable adult. It closes a loophole that to clarify that the reporter's identity is protected at all stages of the investigation and services. And it prevents maltreatment and promotes safety of vulnerable adults and children by allowing adult protection to share information with advocates, federal and state agencies, and licensing boards when necessary to stop or prevent maltreatment. This section really lines up with the authority that we're asking for in a previous section to allow adult protection to share information for the protection of the person, not just for the investigation, and aligns the priority of the safety of the individual as high as the priority of the investigation of the alleged perpetrator. It's person-centered. Section 8 allows the establishment or allows authority for the county who organizes a multidisciplinary adult protection team to include organizations with relevant expertise on their team in addition to those that are currently listed in the statute. And Section 9 expands the functions of the multidisciplinary team that it may include functions other than those that are limited to adult protection so that counties can combine teams with related functions into their multidisciplinary adult protection team. The next sections relate to definitions. Section 10 is the definition of abuse. This establishes one standard for abuse of all vulnerable adults, regardless of their diagnosis and condition or their participation in licensed services. It's just a modernization of the definition, aligning with other current licensing statutes. Caregiver is the Section 11 definition. This is very critical to align the definition of caregiver, which is pertinent to allegations of maltreatment by neglect. This modifies the definition of caregiver to be consistent with our state policy that supports unpaid family caregivers by eliminating the presumption of responsibility for neglect by a family member of a vulnerable adult family member. This is based only on the current statute is based only on the relationship of a family member, making them potentially responsible for neglect simply based on that relationship. This also aligns the definition of caregiver with other critical state policies in supporting unpaid family caregivers. And then Section 12 lines up with the changes that were made under Section 11 to create a separate definition of caregiver and self-neglect. Self-neglect is when the vulnerable adult is not meeting their own essential health or safety needs. And the point here is that whether or not a caregiver, a family member, a caregiver, anyone is responsible for the maltreatment or for the neglect, that it's addressed in one track or another, either through caregiver neglect or through self-neglect, so that we are making the necessary changes to support the vulnerable adult and address the actual neglect need. When a caregiver is not alleged responsible for neglect, yes.
We're running a bit long, okay. And we need to get to the testifiers.
Okay, we're good.
The other three bills, could we?
This is it.
Mute up just a little bit.
This is it. That's the last one. I'm done. We're done. That's it.
Okay. Thank you for that. Sorry to, this is such a critical area of statute, and it truly deserves a great deal of time. So I gave a little more leeway, but certainly we want to make sure we stay on time and get to all the bills we have today. With that, I believe.
Thank you.
Have two testifiers on the schedule for today. The first, Ms. Vikström, if you'd like to state your name and your affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony, and please make sure to try and keep it to 2 minutes.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amanda Vikström, and I am the Executive Director at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and we are a nonprofit organization providing advocacy services to older or vulnerable victims who experience abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. 1 in 10 persons over 60 will be the victim of abuse at some point during their lifetime, and the risk increases to 1 in 5 anytime the victim has some sort of cognitive impairment. And most of this abuse, as stated earlier, happens outside of a long-term care facility, so in the community, and these are the cases to which APS responds. Many of the issues APS faces are caused by some flaws within the system itself. APS overall is underfunded, and the burden primarily lies with the counties, creating equity discrepancies based on where a victim lives or the abuse occurs. Many people do not understand the adult protection system or find frustration that APS did not investigate a certain case. And so along with this confusion, there can also be differences in approaches between counties. APS workers are often forced to wear two very different hats, investigator or social workers. And the investigation hat by nature focuses on the attention on the perpetrator. And this social worker hat is looking at how to resolve the situation for the victim in a victim-centered or person-centered way. And so when the perpetrator is a loved one, does an APS worker have the opportunity to build trust and help the victim? And by doing that, by working to build a case against a perpetrator, does it diminish this by pursuing that the case against a loved one? So the situations are complex and take time and really are best served in a multidisciplinary approach. So this APS redesign will address these issues in the years to come, but the bill in front of you represents really some of the most basic changes that can and should occur now, and it will really help improve our entire APS system. So just a couple to point out, the changes starting at line 4.33 will allow the public to understand a county's priorities, really adding that much needed transparency into the system that Ms. McGurran talked about. And then a second one, sections 8 and 9 make changes to our multidisciplinary teams and their approach in counties. And it really clarifies the role and the members of these critical teams. The Minnesota Elder Justice Center wants to emphasize that these changes are really just the beginning, and we really look forward to continuing our work with DHS and all the stakeholders in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vikstrom. And then I believe we have Ms. Winger on the list for testifying today. If you'd proceed with your testimony.
Hi, thank you. I'm Melissa Winger. I'm giving a personal testimony as a parent of a vulnerable young adult. I'm giving this testimony to highlight the fact that people with severe disabilities and cognitive disabilities are not always in one spot. So they're going from their residential facility, they're going home for visits, they're going to their day programs, they're out in the community. And that is something that we strongly support and we encourage. So I do believe that this bill furthers that silo approach to how we are protecting our vulnerable adults. I think that we need to do better at this, and I'm gonna give you some examples. And these did occur in a residential facility. However, this could definitely happen in others. And the process that I'm trying to highlight is the screening process. So the screening of what gets investigated is likely to continue to be based on where you are at, whether it is the county, whether it is a residential facility, a day program, depending on your licensing. And it's almost impossible for families like myself who have a loved one to be able to sort this out and figure this out. So my story is about my son who lives in a residential facility, an adult corporate foster home. He is now 25 years old. In 2019, after careful review of the DHS licensing tool that people can look up available to the public, showed this facility had no reports of maltreatment. So I felt very confident in my decision to place my son into this home. And this was due to the fact that I could no longer care for his 24-hour needs. At home. So in November of 2019, I received a call from his adult day program about an incident reported by the driver of his transportation. My son has significant medical conditions. He is nonverbal. He is severely cognitively impaired, and he also has severe autism. And the driver was in the van, in the driveway when she witnessed a staff person at the home aggressively dragging my son by his upper arm down the driveway, pushed him into the grill of the van, and proceeded to grab him again and push him into the van floor and slam the door shut. The driver immediately attended to my son, who was crying and showed her his hands. He was missing a glove, and that's why he was upset and didn't want to go. The driver assured him that they would not leave until he had his glove, and after he was given his glove, he signed thank you and gave the driver a hug and wiped away his tears. It is also of note that my son had a boot on his foot because of a broken foot that was still being investigated by the facility as to what occurred. And at that point, I did not realize what my options were for reporting. I thought I had to report at the facility level, and they were currently looking at that incident, which to this day has not been resolved.
Thank you, Ms. Winger.
Well, hold on one second. Can I go okay. A little more? Sorry. I just want to say that after calling the adult intake reporting line, gave all the information, and I got a templated letter that stated that after careful review of the information, gathering additional information, it was determined there will be no further action on your report by the Division of Licensing. and your report will be remain for 3 years. And if additional reports are received, the report will be reviewed and whether to determine if there is a pattern. Less than a month later, his father picked him up and my son was covered in significant bruising, both arms, hand, foot, and hips. And there was no documentation. 2 days later, I reported that incident on the Common Entry Point Central intake line. And I received the same templated email letter 4 days later, saying after review, there will be no further investigation. There's also on these templated letters, no additional action that I can take on my part to review. I do not see any change in this, whether it's at the county level, whether it's at the licensing level, at any level, that this screening process, especially when using the same common entry point, will be changed. There's also significant language in the report that also look at, that they may look at previous incidences. This will also require that counties see if there was incidences reported in any other licensing, DHS, MDH, anything. So I do have significant concerns about what is being screened in and what is being screened out. And it appears that that regulation will still be up to individual licensing agencies. And that in this incidence, even happening in a county situation, I believe will still happen with the proposed changes. And that is unfortunate thing. I think we can do better, we can do more, and we can streamline this. So anywhere that this vulnerable adult is in Minnesota, if they are abused, maltreated, neglected, we'll have the same priority across the entire system. Thank you,
Ms. Binger. I really appreciate your testimony, and I'm sorry that your son was put into that position. I know we want to try to get through as quickly as possible. We do have three other bills, but do we have any questions from members on the bill? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a more of a parliamentary procedural question for you, but I'm looking at the bill and it's evident to me that there are issues of data practices inherent to this bill. I'm wondering why the motion was to lay it over rather than re-refer it to judiciary.
And my apologies, Representative Albright. I was informed after the fact that this actually will be moving on to the Judiciary Committee next. So I had hoped to correct that on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just looking at the bill, I'm just curious if there are consequences of costs that our counties are going to actually foresee in the passage of these changes.
Ms. McGurran, perhaps?
Madam Chair, Representative, committee members, we do not believe that there are costs for counties. They currently have prioritization guidelines. This is making them public. This is making practices across counties consistent.
Thank you, Ms. McGurran. Representative Pearson, did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Albright, you still have your hand up. Did you have an additional question before we move forward?
No, Madam Chair, I do not.
All right, thank you. Well, with that, I will actually correct the record. I will move that we or make a motion to re-refer this House File 1432 to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please unmute yourself and say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Madam Chair.
And I am sorry, Representative Liebling, we need to do a full vote.
Thank you.
I apologize. Ms. Hansen, will you please take the roll?
I'd love to. Thank you. Chair Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Ferkel, aye. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel.
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Moeller, excused. Representative Moore.
Aye.
Moore, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell.
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher, excused. Vice Chair Bonner, that's 17 ayes and 2 excused. You're on mute.
Apologies. Thank you, Representative Fredericks. Then that this 1432 will be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. And it does appear that we have Chair Schultz back, so I will pass the gavel over to her.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. It looks like we're on track on time, so thanks for moving it along. So members, the next bill we have on our agenda is House File 1754. Representative Frederick, would you like to move your bill to place it before the committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
And is it your intent that House File 1754 be placed on the general register? And if so, would you like to move this bill to be placed on the general register?
Yes, please.
So Representative Frederick moves that House File 1754 be placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Frederick. Please tell us about House File 1754.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a technical bill affecting older adults that provides some important updates and clarifying language, primarily for nursing homes and assisted living facilities. This bill aligns outdated language in statute with current policy and other existing laws. It provides cleanup by repealing unnecessary language. This bill provides clear, direct direction to nursing homes by addressing duplicative, obsolete language and provides clarification of cost reporting requirements for nursing facilities. Nursing facilities will be more accurate in properly classifying their costs on their annual cost reports. It also removes a duplicative adult foster care rights rule that already exists somewhere else in statute. Currently, the same adult foster care resident rights exist in two places. This repeal wasn't intended in 2017 when it moved to 254A. Also, perhaps most importantly, this proposal makes some critical changes related to the implementation to assisted living licensure. For those of you who may not already be aware, Minnesota is actually the last state in the nation to license assisted living facilities. The Minnesota licensure established licensure for assisted living facilities in the first time in 2019. And so this bill makes necessarily conforming changes to the DHS statutes as a result of this change. Licenses are set to take to effect in August of this year. While most of these changes simply align with DHS statutes with the new assisted living licensure under the new chapter of law, some are very important changes needed to continuity and the ability for the department to conduct consumer surveys in assisted living settings. For example, the definition of a family adult foster care home currently resides in a chapter of statute that will repeal with the implementation of assisted living licensure. So the language in this bill is needed to retain the definition in law once assisted living facilities are licensed beginning in August of this year. Another very important reason has to do with enabling the department's ability to conduct consumer surveys in both assisted living and nursing facilities. Providers need this language in order to legally provide resident and family contact information to DHS for purposes of independently conducting the consumer surveys without the risk of a HIPAA violation. This language is not only needed to comply with the updates in HIPAA, it is also needed to ensure the surveys are administered independently to ensure consumer responses and participation in the surveys remain anonymous. We feel that the consumer surveys of assisted living residents are especially important now, given the effect that the pandemic has had on everyone, but especially our disability and elder populations. At this point, I would turn it over.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. It looks like we have Director Val Cook here from DHS. I don't know if she wanted to make any comments. If not, we can open it up for members' questions. Director Cook, would you like to add anything to the testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Valerie Cook. I'm the Division Director for Nursing Facility Rates and Policy with the Department of Human Services. I think Representative Frederick covered this well. The only thing I just was going to highlight about is the importance of the language related to the consumer surveys for assisted living on line 6.33. And we just discovered, we've been doing these surveys in nursing homes for 15 years, but we just discovered there have been a couple of updates to the HIPAA law. And as we were rolling out the pilot test on this assisted living, it came to light that providers could be at risk of a HIPAA violation by giving us the contact information. And so we had to do a workaround to keep our pilot test going. But what we did is provide the surveys to the providers that are testing it for us, and they distribute the surveys, which is not a good, valid way to collect consumer data that's evaluating the providers themselves. And so this language is really critical to us to be able to do a valid data collection and ensure that all consumers get to participate in the survey if they choose to. So I just wanted to highlight that. Otherwise, I'm ready for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Director Cook. And I just want to let members know this isn't the first bill we'll see, the only bill we'll see on assisted living licensure. We're working on other technical language and trying to get agreement from the various advocates. I also want to acknowledge all the work DHS and others are doing to get ready to license assisted living facilities during a pandemic. So thank you for all the work you're doing, Director Cook, and to the rest of your team. I'm not seeing any hands raised. I'll give it another 30 seconds to see if we have any questions from members on this technical bill from DHS. Otherwise, Ms. Hansen, will you please take the roll call vote? So Representative Frederick renews his motion to place 1754 on the general register as recommended. Chair votes aye.
Chair Schultz votes aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mahler?
Aye.
Mahler, aye.
Representative
Noor?
Aye.
Noor, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandel?
Aye.
Sandel, aye. And we have Schumacher excused. So that's 18 ayes and one excuse, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion is approved. So thank you, Representative Frederick, for the work you're doing on that bill. And now it is on the general register. So next, members, we have House File 1287. The chair moves that House File 1287 be moved before the committee and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Representative Hollins, I see that you have an amendment. Would you like to move? I believe it's the A1 amendment to get it in the shape you'd like.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is what I would like to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. So I will move the A1 amendment to House File 1287. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if Representative Hollins, I appreciate the fact that she wants to move the A1 to get the bill in this shape that she would prefer. Certainly respectful of that. I'm just wondering if prior to the vote that we could just have a little more information regarding the amendment. Certainly supportive of that, but from a form and function, just making that knowable to the members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Hollins, would you like to describe the A1 amendment for us?
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, actually. So what this amendment does is it amends the language on probation and paroles. So it allows counties to receive information about parole and probation requirements of individuals applying for a license if those individuals agree to sign a waiver of consent. It also it works on the TPR language, so the termination of parental rights. So it changes current law to be more restrictive. So it now requires that individuals who have had a prior involuntary or voluntary termination of parental rights will be barred from qualification for 20 years. We recognize that it's likely that DHS and the counties will need to plan for this shift in the law through new guidance before the bill is implemented in 2022, including publication of the new requirements to notify that those impacted are who are not likely to be aware of the change. And then the final thing that this amendment does is it requires DHS to create foster care guidelines for counties to ensure consistency in licensing practices around the state. And the guidance, this guidance and the new standards must be in place by 2023.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. I know a lot of work has gone into this bill, this legislation by Representative Hollins and by Representative Rena Moran last year. And I really thank them for doing the work here. I know this had bipartisan support in the past, and I believe it does again. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hollins, thank you for the explanation of the amendment. I'm just curious whether or not the county attorneys support the language within the A1 as you move forward with the addition of it to your bill.
Representative Hollins?
I'm trying to remember. I know we've been in communication with the counties, and I know that there's been a ton of work with stakeholders and trying to find these sorts of common ground where we can move forward on this. My understanding is that they are in agreement with this. It really, what this amendment does was seek to find a balance between two conflicting perspectives and really sort of meet in the middle about them.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to belabor the point, but I'm just curious if there is anyone on our Zoom call from the county's attorneys this morning that would confirm that or not. I don't necessarily need that to move it forward. I just wanted to verify that if they were available, that they could weigh in on it. Thank you.
I'm not seeing them available, and I'm not seeing letters opposed or supporting of it. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. And while I appreciate Representative Albright wanting to have an explanation of the amendment, on some bills, and I think this is one of them, it would really help to allow the author to just introduce the bill. And if we could adopt the amendment, I think we could just, she could talk about the bill as amended, because it just occurs to me that although some of us are somewhat familiar with it from the past, that anyone watching this would be utterly confused about what we're talking about. So I would just like to suggest, if Representative Albright would be okay, that we adopt the amendment and that the author then be allowed to explain what it's doing. And then these questions about who's in favor and who's opposed would make a lot more sense. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly agree with Representative Liebling's form and function, but because of the significant changes that this would purport, particularly in this subject matter, I think it's important that people are aware of the magnitude and the ramifications of the amendment. Certainly in support of, as Representative Liebling has portrayed, you know, putting the bill in the form in which the author would prefer it. But I do think in some cases, having that understanding of the amendment prior to the vote just gives a better understanding and informational background to all who are listening, as well as for the committee members. I'm not trying to obstruct the process. I'm just trying to help myself and others be more informed about what is included and what is considered, in my vernacular, a fairly large and wide-ranging amendment. So with that, I'll leave my comments and move to adopt the amendment.
Okay, Representative Liebling, your hand is up. I'm not sure if you have a follow-up. If not, we're going to take a voice vote because no roll call has been called. So a voice vote on the A1 amendment to House File 1287. Please unmute yourself. All those in favor of adopting the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Oh. Okay,
the motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So as Representative Liebling mentioned, there are many people are probably familiar with this bill. It's been worked on for many years at this point. And I think we've really come to a great understanding and some compromises on this. So I'm excited to move this forward. The three main purposes of this bill are to bring Minnesota's foster care licensing standards more in line with our adoption standards, to remove unnecessary barriers that exist in current law for relatives and communities of color seeking foster care licenses, and to ensure the well-being and stability of children. So under current law, our foster care licensing standards and processes create many more barriers for individuals, including relatives, than our adoption standards. This inconsistency creates problems placing children in permanent safe homes, and it isn't good for family preservation or child well-being. This bill also brings Minnesota in line with the current federal policy and recommendations relating to foster care licensing and background checks. It's time for Minnesota to rethink the way we license foster care providers. Unlike providers requiring DHS license, other providers requiring DHS license, family foster homes are not a business. They should be a safe haven for children who cannot live at home. And for communities of color, the statutory barriers in our current foster care licensing statute have an even greater impact. This law would help remedy that disparity. We know that when children can remain with relatives in foster care and stay connected to their families, they have better long-term outcomes, including higher high school graduation rates, decreased risk of mental health disorders, and less overall trauma. This bill is supported by many constituents across a breadth of experience and perspectives, and provides a well-thought-out negotiated balance to ensure both safety for children, but also a reasonable list of barriers that doesn't exclude many wonderful foster care providers who may have had an imperfect past. Now, with that being said, I have two testifiers here today. Would you like me to introduce them, Madam Chair, or would you like to?
I will do that. Thank you, Representative Hollins. So the first testifier we have is Joanna Woolman. Please introduce yourself and your affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. My name is Joanna Woolman. I'm the director of the Institute to Transform Child Protection at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. I'm also a professor there. I'm happy to be here today to support this bill. This is the third session we are bringing this bill and seeking to modify the way that Minnesota provides foster care licenses to all individuals, including relatives. And I don't have a ton to add beyond what Representative Hollins stated. A couple things I would say with respect to Representative Albright's question, the county attorneys are supportive of this effort and have been very involved in all the negotiations that have gotten us to the point where we've arrived at today. Just to briefly describe what this does, I think Representative Hollins described the policy well. We're really trying to match adoption and foster care standards. We are keenly aware of the racial disparities that exist in Minnesota's child welfare system, and this bill seeks to create opportunities for communities of color, in particular relatives and communities of color, to be licensable so that they can take in their relatives. That is one of the large motivations behind this bill and has been for the last several years. This bill creates a new section in the foster care licensing statute in Minnesota. And I think it's important to recognize that one of the things this bill does is really calls out that foster care licenses should be different and should be treated differently and come to differently than all of the other types of licenses required under the Minnesota Department of Human Services. It recognizes that foster care is not a for-profit business or a business at all, like an in-home daycare, and that the specific concerns related to child safety should be narrow and focused so that we're not excluding individuals who are the best fit for children in any given situation. One of the things this bill does in addition is provides more requirements on DHS, sort of a data forward provision, which requires DHS to give more data upfront to counties so that counties have more information and the licensing workers in counties have more specific information when they are making a decision about a foster care license. And one of the other things I would point out, of course, is that there are many checks on the system when people in Minnesota apply for a foster care license, right? The county makes an initial recommendation. The Department of Human Services is ultimately responsible for providing that license based on the county's recommendation. So that's a check. And then for cases that are involved in our child welfare system, of course, there's judicial oversight over any placement of children that happens in Minnesota. I don't have much else to offer. I'm completely happy to answer questions. I would just say this has been a long road. We are happy to be here. I personally would just like to thank all of the stakeholders and individuals who came together to work on this bill over the last 3 years. Thank you so much, Representative Hollins and Representative Moran. Look forward to answering any questions.
Thank you, Professor Woolman, and thank you for all of your expertise and working on this bill as well. The next testifier I see is Alexis Oberdorfer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexis Oberdorfer. I'm the president of Children's Home Society of Minnesota and the associate vice president of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. I represent two of the longest standing foster care and adoption programs that have existed in Minnesota dating back to the 1800s. I have over 25 years of professional experience in child welfare. And in any given year, we place over 200 children in foster care and adoption placements. Regardless of which door a family enters, there should be parity in the criteria that we use for foster care and adoption background checks. In 2018, we partnered with a Metro County to assist kinship caregivers that needed to be licensed where they were considering caring for a Black child who had entered foster care. In that year, we served 34 families, and approximately 25% of those families needed to request a licensing variance. We witnessed how the foster care licensing criteria creates barriers for the BIPOC community. There were two cases, an example that really stood out to me. The first case is Aunt Addie. She came forward to care for her niece and her nephew, and she ran into a background check issue with a charge from 15 years earlier for a check fraud. She had paid restitution. She didn't expect to see this. We supported her in seeking that licensing variance, and it was granted. She became an amazing resource for these two young kids, ages 1 and 3. She provided the continuity to their family. She mitigated trauma that they would have experienced if they were placed with a non-relative caregiver. And ultimately, these kids were reunited with their birth father. Grandma Joy was another caregiver that we worked with. She was the grandmother who needed to step in and care for her granddaughter. She had just lost her daughter to an opioid overdose. She had experienced a lot of grief and loss in the loss of her daughter, but then endured a series of obstacles to becoming foster care licensed. She's caring for her 5-year-old granddaughter, and she's needing to figure out how to get through the system. So she found out that there was a 12-year-old charge for economic assistance fraud in her background that was holding her up from getting licensed. We helped her seek a variance as well. She did become licensed in the fall of 2018, and in 2019, she ended up adopting her granddaughter. I asked my management team about what our data looked like for non-relative foster care and adoptive families, and they informed me that less than 5% of the families that we worked with needed to seek variances to be able to become licensed. Research excuse me, research shows that relatives and kin are oftentimes the most stable placements. They promote resilience for children and youth and out-of-home placements. We appreciate looking at the and changing the criteria for the background study process to mitigate any further disparities that BIPOC communities experience in child welfare and helping them become foster care licensed, particularly for relative and kin. I urge you to pass House File 1287. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Oberdorfer, and thank you for all of the work you and your team are doing, and we appreciate it. And thank you for also giving us those examples, those concrete examples. The next testifier I have is Kate Rickard. Please introduce yourself, your name and affiliation, and begin your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kate Rickard. I'm a senior director at St. David's Center Foster Care, and I'm here representing Aspire Minnesota in addition to Quality Parenting Minnesota. I would like to thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 1287. Reform to our licensing process is vital to reduce the barriers of fostering for families and ultimately the community. Community-based foster care organizations, which is a private agency that supports and provides oversight for licensed foster parents, values the licensing process has changed, indicated in this legislation. Removal from home is an adverse childhood experience for our children. Our goal, when this is deemed necessary for safety, should be on preserving and healing relationships for the child and parents. The modifications outlined in this bill can reduce the stress and chaos when an out-of-home placement is required. Our QPI communities in Minnesota are working hard to improve the experience of foster care through excellent parenting and developing meaningful relationships that last beyond out-of-home placement. As we elevate the lived experience voices, those of the youth, the parents, and our foster parents within the foster care system, as experts to generate solutions to barriers, the need to make accommodations and look at kinship families through their individual lens is necessary. Over the past 9 years in my work at a private agency, I have seen changes in the focus from moving to from non-relative homes and looking to relatives and kin as the priority. This is a positive shift for children and families, and this legislation honors that individuals can change and evolve and that indiscretions of the past do not reflect abilities of today. We must align our policies to the best practices for children and families. Community foster care providers have been active in supporting this proposal and appreciate all of the expert voices who have shaped it. By reducing barriers in the licensing process, we will no longer have to inform families that they are unable to care for their grandbabies due to circumstances when they were 18 years old. One disqualification that stays in my mind from our organization is when a grandfather's prior theft of checks and a vehicle from his own parents when he was young led to a disqualification. These old charges did not pose a risk of harm to his grandchildren 25 years later. This legislation will make a significant impact to reduce fragmentation that our youth, families, and the community experience due to licensing barriers. We look forward to your support in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rickard. Are there any questions for members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the testifiers. And Representative Hollins, thank you for indulging me with form and function at the initiation of your presentation. This is an issue that really invokes strong passions on both sides, and it certainly invokes the heritage of who is to raise children, but they should be raised in a safe and supportive environment. And with that, and particularly in conversations I've had with the county attorney's office in Hennepin County, I support this initiative, and I'll be adding my name as a co-author.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I know, I believe you were a co-author last session as well, so we appreciate that. Any other questions from members? Not seeing any. Representative Hollins, any closing comments?
I would just like to thank you, Madam Chair, and thank the committee and my testifiers today. This has been a really long process, and I cannot take credit for it. As you know, I'm very new to the legislature, but a lot of hard work has gone into this, and I think we have a really good, solid bill. So I appreciate any and all support that you would give to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. So the chair renews my, I renew my motion to re-refer House Bill 1287 as amended to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. We are going to take the roll call. Ms. Hansen, the chair votes aye.
Aye. Vice Chair Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright.
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle.
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Moore.
Yes.
Moore, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell.
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher, excused. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Thank you. That's 18 ayes and one excuse, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hollins. You're on your way with your bill to judiciary, and good luck. Okay, members, wow, we are ahead of schedule. So the next item on our agenda is House File 1484, but first we need to, I'm gonna move to adopt the division report from the Preventing Homelessness Division. It's before the committee. This is a voice vote. So all those in favor of adopting the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Nay.
Okay, the division report is adopted. So members, this bill, House File 1484, has been discussed extensively, and the policy has, in Preventing Homelessness Division. But with that said, I'm going to move House File 1484 to be re-referred to the Labor, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Keeler, welcome back to the committee. Please tell us about your bill, House File 1484.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am excited to be here to talk about this with you. House File 1484 is around creating micro units on sacred spaces. What we know and what we've learned in Preventing Homelessness Committee is what I'm sure we all know is that homelessness is a massive issue spanning across multiple areas of our state, and everybody has a different story. It is gonna take a massive collaboration for us to work together to solve homelessness and actually prevent it. So what this bill is our faith-based organizations have stepped up to the challenge and want to be a part of this movement. We are really excited about this. We passed it unanimously in Preventing Homelessness, and we have really strong bipartisan buy-in over in the Senate. Senator Housley is authoring it over in the Senate, and we are working with multiple different agencies to move this forward quickly, hopefully. Also, the nice thing about it is that this is no cost to the state. The faith-based organizations and nonprofits are the ones that are going to fund this. We really just need to work on a couple tweaks in our codes to make this accessible. And so with that, I know that we have a short amount of time, and we did have a pretty extensive conversation about this, but I'll just end with the fact that everybody deserves a home. Everybody deserves a safe space to go at the end of the night with a roof over their head. We know that that in itself plays a role into so many of these other issues, whether it's around education outcomes, healthcare outcomes, and many more. So Madam Chair, I will pass it over to the two testifiers that I have here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. The first testifier I have is Ann Krisnick. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
I'm Ann Krishnick with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and this issue came to us from a number of faith communities that wanted to, in a very concrete way, address chronic homelessness in their area. They really like the model of Community First that is put together by a nonprofit Settled, which I'll talk about in a moment, but found that there were some limitations in Minnesota law that allowed them to move forward. So really what this bill does is it looks at people who've experienced chronic homelessness and said, instead of just saying we're going to provide a place for you to sleep, we want to provide you a community where you are invited and welcomed and a place where you can belong. Because a lot of these people have experienced serious trauma, many adverse experiences, both in childhood and often into adulthood. And we want to give them a place where they feel safe and where they can be healed. A key component of this, aside from the no cost to government, is that we have missionals, which are people who are called to live out this need to love their neighbor in a really profound way. And so these are people who are housed and they're choosing intentionally to be part of a community that is made up of both housed and unhoused people. So these people give up their home or their apartment. We have a community in St. Paul that's ready to move forward. And one of the missionals there is a single woman with that is living on her own, and the other is a couple with two small children. So there'll be six units and two will be filled by the missionals. If you look at structurally, they are built around either a church building as the common house, or they may have a separate building. There's a unit in Forest Lake that will be focusing on homeless veterans, and they'll actually build a separate space as a common house. And in that area, there are full bathrooms, showers, laundry, full kitchen, places to eat together, to gather, as well as private rooms to meet with a caseworker or a mental health professional. And that space is available 24/7. And then just outside of that are the individual micro units, which you see mentioned in the bill. So these are similar to what you think of as a tiny house. So each person staying there has their own dwelling, and they can go in, they can lock the door and be safe. They can bring their pets with them if they want to, but that has a place to sleep, a place to prepare food in the kitchen, to eat, to invite people in for hospitality, as well as a bathroom with either a dry or compostable toilet. And they're built using materials that would be used in residential construction. So we need a change in the law really for two reasons. One, the model is based on that they're not all faith communities can have a settlement on their property, but many of them can contribute something. So for example, the six units in St. Paul were all built by six separate churches in different cities, all happen to be different denominations. They're built on a trailer and then they're moved to the site and they're permanently anchored there. And they build steps up to them so each person has their front stoop. But under Minnesota law, because they're on wheels, they're considered a recreational vehicle and they cannot be used for permanent housing. We know that many of the people that have experienced chronic homelessness may never be able to move on to a more traditional form of housing. And a big piece of this is being able to say to people, as long as you pay your rent or work it off with meaningful work at the parish, as long as you follow the rules, this can be a permanent home for you. The second is they don't meet the requirements of the state building code. And in large part, that's because of size, as well as the compostable toilet right in my unit, even though I have access to a toilet somewhere else. We've been working closely with the League of Minnesota Cities to assure that the bill incorporates. We're using very high materials and high level of workmanship and make sure that that's incorporated in the bill so that if any other nonprofit were to try to use this, they would also be meeting those standards, as well as addressing some inspection issues with them. And in the hearing below, there's support from the Minnesota Coalition from the Homeless, from MICA, from a significant number of faith communities, from a professor of architecture at the University of Minnesota that heads up the design center there, that really views this as a model, not only with wonderfully safe and dignified housing, but really a model that's replicable and could really show Minnesota being a leader in a way to move forward with this. We have our general contractor available to testify after me to talk about any questions you might have about safety or standards, but I really ask that you approve this House File 1484 and allow these faith communities to move ahead in a way to address this problem that they feel called to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krishnick. We have Brandon Overholt. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Brandon Overholt. I, for the last 5 years, have been a licensed general contractor here in the cities. I've grown up Mennonite. I've been around building basically my whole life. I started holding a job. I actually started holding a regular job when I was around 13. So I've been in the trade about 25 years and self-employed for 15 years of that. As far as these micro units and how they're built, I would just like to emphasize the fact that they are built with like normal materials that we use for building real houses that people live in. Actually, as far as the energy code goes, we've been holding a higher standard than what Minnesota requires of us, in the sense that we are foaming them all, like spray foaming, instead of using traditional fiberglass insulation, to try and create a more secure envelope as far as saving energy and so on, with an air exchanger in there to provide fresh air for the inhabitants. The materials like windows, doors, things like that, the components that go into actually creating the house are of familiar quality, like Marvin and Anderson windows and doors. I think you're probably familiar with that. So most of them are built in Minnesota here. It's really, they're really beautiful. They provide dignity. It's not just a little shack for people to go into and to sleep. I think it's a beautiful space for them to maybe, you know, require some inspiration and to whatever opportunities life may hold for them in the future. I think that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Overhold, for being in front of our committee today and testifying and for working on this initiative. I see a question from Representative Sandell.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair, and Representative Keeler for bringing the bill. It sounds like a terrific program. I have just a couple questions. One, have the allies and participants in this been working with the housing authorities, for example, in Minneapolis and St. Paul? And second of all, do the adults or any of the adults that will occupy these small homes have children with them? Thanks.
You, Representative Sandell. Ms. Krisnick or Representative? Go ahead, Ms. Krisnick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll answer those in two parts. We've been working really closely with the city of St. Paul. The parish that is ready to go is on the east side. They currently have a safe parking program for women and women with children who are homeless, where they can stay overnight. And so the city's put this together. They've been working really closely with the city, and the city has responded by saying, we can't go farther than this until this becomes lawful. Under the Department of Labor and Industry standards, we can't approve you going forward. So we recognize that we need to work closely with those housing authorities, or in a smaller city, they may not have that, but with the cities, and really view this as a community asset. These are people that are maybe going to the emergency room, prompting police calls. We want to make sure that they have a place to live. So we view us as being allies with the city and want to work closely with them to make sure this works. The question regarding children, no. The only children that would be in the settlement would be those that come with the missionals. So.
Thank you, Ms. Krisnick. Representative Sandell, any follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the work everyone's doing on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate hearing this. I understand that most of my questions relevant to 1484 probably are germane if I were sitting in labor or in judiciary, civil law. But I hope you'll indulge me for just a couple of questions here. My first question is for Mr. Overholt. I'm giving his name correctly. Wondering if he could just expand, coming from a construction background, I'm just wondering if you could give us some idea in terms of the price per square foot, the imprint, the footprint of it in terms of size. I'm fairly familiar with chapter 1360 and 61, but I'm just wondering in terms of, my understanding is that some of the reason and rationale for this bill was to alleviate some of the regulatory environment around construction of these facilities. So what are we avoiding by this bill?
Madam Chair, may I respond briefly?
Sure, Ms. Krznick.
Madam Chair, may I respond briefly?
Yes.
I just want to put the big reason we need the bill is that these units would be totally lawful for temporary housing if we simply wanted to house people over the winter and then say you no longer have a place for the summer. So the bill would allow us to use them for permanent housing. And so I just want to be really clear that we recognize that for some of these people, the permanency is really a big piece. And then I'll turn it over to Mr. Overholt to talk specifically.
Mr. Overholt?
Yes, responding to as price per foot, to the question about price per foot, these are going to be very comparable to what we build new homes for. They vary a little bit between 125 to 150 per foot, just depending on what kind of material as far as siding or interior liner goes into them. Just things like that.
Thank you, Mr. Overholt. One more question, Representative Albright. Then I have Representative Robbins and Representative Rasmussen on the list, and then we needed to go to a vote. So one more question, Representative Albright, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll choose it as efficiently as I can. This question would actually be for Ms. Krznick. I note in your definition for sacred settlement that it includes establishing permanent housing for not only homeless persons, very low income persons, but also staff and volunteers. I'm particularly curious why you include staff and volunteers if the predicate for this initiative is to house those that have no home or housing. And just as an issue, I'll add just one thing in terms of you did not articulate in terms of which religious institutions currently are interested in this other than just naming them by community. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that point.
Ms. Krznick?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, two comments. The draft the amendments, once we incorporate those on construction matters as well, will change that language from staff and volunteers to use the word missional and then define missionals as someone who's intentionally choosing to live in part of this community in lieu of other permanent housing. So we have no intention of this just being a church could set up one home for a youth pastor, for example. With regard to your second question, and I'm drawing a blank, I'm so sorry.
Which organizations are?
Currently, the two that are most ready to go is Mosaic Community, Christian Community, which is on the east side of St. Paul, and Faith Lutheran Church, which is located in Forest Lake, which will be focusing on homeless veterans. Currently, all of the churches are all of the people or all of the organizations are Christian churches, but under the statute, it would be something that could be a mosque or a synagogue or a Buddhist temple or any other religious organizations. But we specifically wrote that to try to limit it to not having every nonprofit be able to do this at this point. We're trying to have a very limited scope.
Thank you, Ms. Krznick. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the bill author and the testifiers. So I want to be supportive of this. I think it's a great idea. My church has been active for many years in community things like this and homelessness and a food shelf. So I care about this issue a lot. But I also have some concerns about, first, you kind of mentioned that the reason we need a state law, not just let this be up to cities, is because of a DALI provision. So I'm interested in understanding why this can't be handled city by city. And then under that rubric, will neighbors be consulted? I mean, this could be kind of a disruptive thing in a community. And so, how will that be addressed? And also, if this was a mobile home park or something more permanent, and it was a business, they would have to carry insurance and have liability protections. And I'm just concerned for churches, how what this will mean for them if there's, you know, a drug overdose or some sort of adverse event in one of these communities, what their liability will be. There's no description of any liability or insurance requirements in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Ms. Krznick?
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, the reason we need a change is currently anything on wheels is considered temporary housing. It's considered a recreational vehicle and it's lawful to use those for permanent housing. And this is a recognition that some of the people that we'd be dealing with will not be able to move into what you would typically think of as, you know, they might not be able to move into an apartment or something else. When disability, they have mental health issues. And so we want to recognize right up front that we're dealing with people that this would be their permanent housing. And so that's why we need the change. Regarding the neighbor piece, I think that this speaks to both of the other pieces. If you look at the last two lines of the bill, they talk about a conditional use permit with the city. And we've been talking with the League of Minnesota Cities about maybe building out that language a little bit more about what would need to be included. But those would have things, for example, about quiet hours, or if the city wants a fence built around this, or whatever we might want to do in order to make that work. We want to be considered a community asset. And so we'll be working very closely with cities in the neighborhood in order to build support and see how we work best going forward. In terms of liability, the church actually will have a lease with each of the people staying in the dwellings, both those who've experienced chronic homelessness and the missionals will pay rent and have a lease with the church. So they are in essence becoming landlords for those individuals with the right to evict and having obligations, but they are not in structuring this in such a way, or the model is not structured that they are the service provider. Most of these people will continue receiving services from the county as they're eligible for now. So the church's liability insurance would be responsible for anything that happens on their site. And I just want to make sure to point out, people sometimes have concerns about what kind of people will be staying there. And I just want to remind you that the churches will be carefully screening people, because the people that are living there are part of their church or synagogue or mosque community. They're going to be having their parishioners, adults through children, in that space over the course of every week. And so there are a number of people that wouldn't be appropriate for this model, but they'll be very carefully screened to make sure that they're a good fit for this.
Thank you, Ms. Krznick. Representative Robbins, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick follow-up. So until you said that, which I really appreciate, I didn't understand that there would be rent paid and that the church would become a landlord. And I just got out of judiciary sitting in a very long hearing over all the ins and outs of tenant rights and eviction notices. And I mean, it is incredibly complicated and there's a lot of changes coming on the eviction side and like regulating temperature and landlord responsibilities. My concern, even though I really support the heart of this, is that this is biting off a lot for a church, especially if they will become actual landlords. So I would just encourage more of that to be spelled out in the bill, or maybe in the city regulations or wherever that's appropriate. But those pieces and the effect on the congregation that has this great intention is a concern to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. I'll just say that I'm really appreciative of the religious organizations that are taking this on and that responsibility, and it's their choice if they want to go forward. But I'm excited about the possibility of moving people from unsheltered to sheltered, and I think we can also hopefully support that. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Keeler for her work on this important bill, and also thank the communities of faith who are called to serve in this way. I think it's really inspiring to see communities and to hear about, you know, their willingness to go out and serve their neighbors in this way. The only thing I wanted to say, Madam Chair, is just would encourage us to collectively continue looking at creative solutions like this in our building code to improve, you know, the housing situation outside of just government expenditure. I know Representative Keeler underscored that in her remarks, and I think that's just an avenue that we should continue thoughtfully looking at our building code and restrictions to see if there's other opportunities to improve housing solutions for these individuals. So I look forward to supporting the bill today, and thank Representative Keeler again for her work.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Thank you, members, for all the great questions. Representative Keeler, do you have any closing comments before we go to a voice vote or a roll call vote?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing us today. You know, we're doing our very best to think outside of the box because this is such a massive issue. I think each and every one of us have some sort of homeless concerns in each of our communities. And so we're just doing our best to start this massive conversation. So I've took a lot of notes on all the suggestions and things and concerns that you have brought up, and we will continue to work on this. Again, I think that this is a human issue. This has nothing to do, you know, with different aspects of it. So when we can come together and work collectively for next generations, this is gonna be huge. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler, and to our thank you to our testifiers for being with us today to explain the bill. Members, I'm gonna renew my motion to re-refer House File 1484 to Labor, Finance, and Policy. So, Ms. Hansen, can you please take the roll? Chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright? Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Knorr?
Knorr, aye.
Knorr, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny is aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Thank you. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Albright?
My apologies. Albright votes aye.
Albright votes aye. Chair Schultz, that's 19 ayes.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion passes, and thank you all. So members, we have several bills on the agenda for tomorrow at 10:30 on child safety. And then we are going to recess and come back at 6 o'clock on Wednesday to hear additional bills. I'm also going to waive our committee rules to allow bills to be added for Wednesday evening to add testifiers and to add the ability to send out handouts. So we're just trying to move and hear as many bills as we can before the first few committee deadlines. So members, please put that on your calendar for tomorrow, 10:30, then we'll recess and come back at 6 p.m. Wednesday evening. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.